Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Minding Maimonides. An exciting day today. Today, please God, we will begin the last chapter of Shmona Prakim, eight chapters, which is the Rambam's eight work, which introduces his commentary to the Mishnah on Pirkei Avot. I found it very informative and enlightening. I hope you have as well. Don't worry, we're not done yet. This last chapter will be quite involved. Let me say that from the outset. I don't think we'll finish it today. But I would say that to sort of paint a picture, the Rambam is sort of building a ladder for us. And I would say if there's one theme that sort of unites all eight chapters, it's that of human potential. The Rambam is painting a picture for us about the incredible potential that humans have, starting from working on character and painting a picture of the appropriate balance of character traits. He spoke about the nature of free time and dedicating all of one's actions and activities toward their knowledge of God. Last week, we spoke about probably the pinnacle of human achievement, as that is achieving the status of the prophet. And the Rambam is very clear that in order to do that, person needs to both strive for intellectual and moral perfection. So today we begin the last chapter, which is about a very involved topic, and I think sometimes a very challenging topic, and one that can take us in a lot of different directions, one I know that some of you are very passionate about, and that is the topic of free will. In chapter eight of the eight chapters, the Rambam discusses the importance or the notion of free will. This is obviously a huge topic. One can spend a long time discussing free will. There's lots of Jewish sources, secular sources, a lot of big questions. I want to focus on the Rambam's perspective. But before doing that, let's I want to discuss it a little bit. So let me ask you the first a very basic question or request. Please raise your hand if you feel that you have free will.
What?
Raise your hand if you have free will. Okay, I see a few people raising their hands. Alan's iPad raised his hand physically and virtually, so he doubly believes in free will. Okay, so that's good. Anybody not? I see Charlie, you have not raised your hand. Do you not think that you have free will? You think you do not have free will? Can't hear you, my friend. I'm sorry.
I didn't raise my hand because I don't think free will is like 100% free will.
Okay, good.
And
But let me ask you a basic question. Whose choice was it not to raise your hand? It
that's a
seems to
good
me some people
question.
chose to raise their hands. Some people chose not to raise their hands. And it seems to me, and I know it's complicated, don't worry, don't jump on me yet. Please, let's be civil. It seems to me that I think very intuitively, we all feel that we all just had a choice of whether or not to raise our hand. So we could have said, I do believe in free will and raised our hands. We could have said, I don't believe in free will and not raised our hands. We could have said, I do believe in free will, but I don't really want to raise my hand because I just don't feel like it. We could have said, I'm going to show the rabbi that I can do what I want and raise my hand even though I don't believe in free will. And those are all choices at our disposal. So I think on a simple level, we feel and sense that we have control over much of our decisions and much of our actions.
Is that your definition of free will?
Ultimately. Okay, we'll get to that, Paul. Hold on. We'll have to define it. But let me ask you another question. Who here thinks that they have control over all of their actions? So that also doesn't seem to be the case, right? So let me ask you this question. Do you have the free choice of whether or not you want to sneeze? Doesn't seem like we do. You know, we can't choose not to sneeze when we need to. There are certainly some functions that some of our bodily functions are not under our control. Furthermore, there are certain things that happen to us that aren't under our control, right? So I can choose to, you know, book a restaurant reservation. I can call up the restaurant. I can give them my name. I can make the reservation. And then I could get there, and lo and behold, they lost my reservation, and I don't have anywhere to sit. You know, this maybe this has happened to somebody here before. Such things happen, and that's clearly not under my control. Clearly, right? There's nothing that I really could have done to prevent that. I might have called them up. I could have reminded them. Ultimately, I'm not the one making that decision. So certainly there are certain things that are not under the realm of our control. So that's certainly a factor to keep in mind. Let me ask you one last question. One last question, okay? And this is a contemporary issue. So I think it's been on a lot of our minds. I don't want to get into the politics of it. I just want to ask a very basic question, okay? You and I both know that there are a lot of vaccine mandates that exist. And I'm not arguing whether we are pro the vaccine mandates, anti, that's not my question. Say, we'll say someone's name is Joel. Joel works for a restaurant in Ontario. There's a vaccine mandate to determine, which dictates that for Joel to remain employed in that restaurant, he needs to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Okay? Does Joel have free will in that decision? Is it Joel's, is it 100% Joel's choice to get vaccinated or not? See, a lot of people are saying yes. Anyone think maybe not so much? Or at least not the same? Go for it, Lisa. What do you think?
No, I think he had a choice, whatever he decided. And I actually think we do have free will, but I do believe that God knows what we're going to choose.
Okay, we'll get to that. Yeah, good.
Okay.
Good. Very good. So we had a choice. Anyone take a bit of an issue with that? Well, let me give you a different example then. Let me give you a different example. Let's say, you are working for a real estate agent and you're selling houses, okay? And say you have a prospective buyer. And let's hope this never happens. And say one day, you get a knock on the door, and there's a pretty big fellow who looks pretty powerful. And he says, I'm going to give you the following advice. Do not by any means go forward with this sale. That's my advice to you. Have a nice day. And then he leaves. Do you have free choice as to whether or not you're going to go through the sale? So I think most of us would say, and tell me if you're different, yes, you certainly, ultimately, it depends on what you mean by free, doesn't it? Meaning, it's very clear in that case, you could, you have an option, you have two alternatives. You have an alternative to go through with it or not. You can get vaccinated or you cannot. But it's hard to say it's free in the sense that they're both equally weighed in your mind. There certainly is. Sorry, Ralph, I'm just going to mute you because there's a bit of background. I apologize. But just to say, please unmute. There certainly is something in the sort of recesses of your mind pushing you to choose one of the options in front of you. So if we're going to argue that there is such a thing as free will, it doesn't mean that you don't have any pressure or there are no factors influencing your decision-making. There may be many factors influencing many of the decisions you make. And it could be that some of those factors which influence our decision-making are beyond our control. I'm hungry. I walk by and there's something on the table. There is a physiological impulse within me telling me I should go eat that thing. I can't really control that impulse. I can fight against it. I could just say no. If it's Yom Kippur, I could say, even though there is a physiological impulse inside of me dictating that I should go, trying to get me to go eat that thing and sending certain messages to my brain and certain neurons are being fired off, I can say there's another impulse inside of me which is saying I don't want to go forward with that decision, but that physiological impulse still exists. So we could go back and forth as to whether or not it's totally free. But what it does seem then, if we're going to argue for free will, it doesn't mean free in the sense that there's no pressure to take either option. It means the ultimate decision that if a person has two alternatives, the ultimate decision as to which alternative to choose is within their realm of choice. That's a very, I could say, a very basic definition of free will. Now, I know a bunch of people mentioned this, so before we go on, we'll read the Rambam. He's not going to necessarily deal with all of these, but let me ask you a question. What challenges do you think there are to the concept of free will? What things, either theological or scientific, what factors bother you or do you think may contradict this notion of free will? Would you say? Lisa said one before, so I'm going to give her that shot.
There's a whole legal code that you have to weigh and will influence your choices.
That certainly influences your choice, that's for sure. A legal code, okay.
Law you may not have. You may not have all the information.
Okay.
You have a choice, but you if you don't have all the information as the results of that choice, you don't have all the information before you to make a proper choice.
Okay, that's true. But ultimately, whether you do it or not is on you, right? You can decide whether you do it or not, even if it's not as well informed. Go for it. Alan, what do you think? What are the challenges to free will?
Well, it's also the collective, whether that's in a corporation or in a shul or something else, where morals, you might believe in one thing, but for the betterment of the organization, you might have to do something else.
Right. You know, I'll put it in a different way. There are certain things that are not. We can be physically coerced to do things, even in halacha, right? You know, let's say, say someone puts a gun to your head and says, do X, Y, or Z, right? So that's, or even more, someone takes your hand and physically moves it for you, right? So there are certain things that certainly are not under your control totally. And even halachically, you're not liable for if a person is compelled to violate a mitzvah or do an avera and it's under compulsion, they're not liable for it. That's called onis, right? That's a whole legal category. But I think the some challenges that I think are pretty classic, I think there are three challenges to free will, I would argue. So there's the more modern scientific challenge, which is this, or you could say it's philosophical. Some call this determinism, which is that, you know, we live in a world of cause and effect, and there seems every single effect seems to have a cause. And the question, one question philosophers I believe ask is, if that is truly so and all effects have causes, then what room is there for free will? Isn't our decision-making process part of the world, the cause and effect? And on a scientific level, some would argue that even though it seems that, you know, we feel that we had the freedom to choose between alternatives, but there are all sorts of biological factors, environmental factors, psychological factors that influence the way we think. And there are neurons being fired off in our brains. And those are ultimately what determine our decisions. So one challenge is that even though it seems, it's sort of, I guess we could say, a philosophical scientific challenge that some are bothered by, which is to say that, you know, maybe you're really just the product. Your decisions are just the product of various causes beyond your control based on your your genetics, based on your environment and based on the way you were raised. And those are truly influence your decision. And maybe you don't have free will. That's one challenge, which is something worth considering. Although, again, I do think it's very hard to go about life saying you don't really have freedom of choice. It's hard to like have any sense of right and wrong without freedom of choice. So we'll get to that. But I think that's one challenge. The other one's a theological challenge, which is the challenge of divine foreknowledge. Right? So as Lisa said before, if God knows the future, and not only does God know the future, God knows our thinking. He knows what's going on in our mind. He knows our decision-making process. He knows sort of, you know, when we're thinking of doing X or doing Y, and he knows what we will ultimately decide. So if God knows we're going to do, you know, if God knows we're, you know, which meaning to say, if it's Shabbos and, you know, it's time to make Kiddush, and God knows we're going to make Kiddush because he sees the future, and it has to be that God's vision of the future is accurate, because if it's not accurate, then that would mean God saw something inaccurate. So God knows we're going to make Kiddush. So then does that mean we had the choice? That's one question. How could we have a choice to make Kiddush if God already knew we were going to make Kiddush? And that compels us to make Kiddush, his knowledge. So there's a second challenge is divine foreknowledge and free will. And the thing is a third challenge. Maybe some of you will get it, right? Anybody remember the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim? What happens with Pharaoh in the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim?
His heart right. Hardened.
Yeah. So what happened to free will? God, what does God hardening Paro's heart mean? And there are a lot of psukim. There are a number of psukim that indicate that there are certain times where it seems like people's free choice was taken away from them. And can they be held liable for the actions that they took when they were no longer in possession of the freedom of choice? Could they not be held liable? So that's more of like a textual problem with the biblical text of this notion of free will. So the Rambam's going to grapple with all of these. So with that introduction, and sort of once we're in the mindset, what I'd like to do now is read some of this Rambam with you. And I think what we'll see is the Rambam is a very big and maximalistic proponent of free will. He thinks that we have almost total freedom to choose what we want to do and whom we want to be. So with that, I'll share my screen with you. And while we read this, I want you to ponder the following question. Why is this so important to the Rambam? And how does it relate to what we've been learning in terms of human character and development? Why is it so important to the Rambam that this is so? So I'm going to share my screen now with you, and we can begin to read together. Here it goes. Says the Rambam. This is chapter 8 of the 8 chapters. The last chapter is one of Prakrit. I'll read the English, but always if you choose to read the Hebrew, that's obviously the original text. It is impossible for man to be born endowed by nature from his very birth with either virtue or vice. Just as it is impossible that he should be born skilled by nature in any particular art. What does the Rambam mean? It is impossible for a man to be born endowed by nature from his very birth, either virtue or vice. What is he saying is impossible? Give me an example of a virtue. Give me any virtue.
Doing good to others.
Okay, doing good to others.
Chesed.
Being a Baal Chesed, kindness. So the Rambam's saying it's impossible to be born a kind person. Now that might strike you in a certain way. That's why we need the next sentence. It is possible, however, that through natural causes, he may from birth be so constituted as to have a predilection for a particular virtue or vice. Meaning, you might have a certain hereditary gene which drives you toward a certain direction, but it doesn't mean that you are determined to express that tendency. So a person can have a predilection for a particular virtue or vice, so that he will more readily practice than any other. For instance, A man who's natural, and this is going to have some old science. So, you know, whether just sort of take the Rambam's word for it right now, this is how the brain works. Probably not, but this is what the Rambam thought. For instance, a man whose natural constitution inclines toward dryness, whose brain matter is clear and not overloaded with fluids, finds it much easier to learn, remember, and understand things than the phlegmatic man whose brain is encumbered with a great deal of humidity. Again, I don't know that this is true on a biological level, but apparently the Rambam thought that it is better biologically to have a dry brain, to have less fluid in the brain. This is what the Rambam thought. Again, I'm not endorsing the science here. And so the Rambam's point is, without getting into the dryness or moistness of one's brain, the point is, some people were endowed with a certain sort of brain, which makes certain sort of intellectual activity come more naturally to them. And some people have the opposite. That's true. That is certainly the case. But if one who inclines constitutionally, meaning in terms of their makeup, towards a certain excellence, is left entirely without instruction, and his faculties are not stimulated, he will undoubtedly remain ignorant. You could have a very, very naturally, intellectually gifted person, but if no one ever teaches them anything, then they are not predetermined to be wise. They will not necessarily acquire knowledge. It is not that the choice to be wise and acquire knowledge was given to them. On the other hand, again, if one by nature dull and phlegmatic, meaning their brain is less naturally gifted, possessing an abundance of humidity, it's very strange to think about. You know, if you ever want to insult someone, you could be like, you humid brain, you know? Anyway, if one who is less naturally gifted is instructed and enlightened, he will, though with difficulty, it is true, gradually succeed in acquiring knowledge and understanding. So the point is, what he's saying is that, listen, you could say you don't have a choice as to whether or not you're going to be a wise person or an unwise person, because isn't that totally based on the talents that you have been given? To which Ram says, no, it is not based on the talents that you are given. Yes, you may have a natural, it may be easier for some than others. Some may have a more of a natural tendency towards learning and wisdom. Some people are more studious. Some people have naturally better study habits. They have more determination naturally. But all of those are tools that you have, but it is your choice how you would like to use those tools. And even if a person lacks those tools, they can acquire wisdom through the appropriate training. And even if a person has those tools, she may not acquire wisdom if she does not have the appropriate training. This is all pretty basic, I think. He says similarly regarding courage. In exactly the same way, he whose blood is somewhat warmer, again, biology aside, than is necessary, has the requisite quality to make him a brave man. Again, for some reason, the Rambam thought warm blood caused a tendency toward being brave. So I'm not sure if that's true, but there are certain people who genetically are braver. Another, however, the temperament of whose heart is colder than it should be, is naturally inclined towards cowardice and fear, so that if he should be taught and trained to be a coward, he would easily become one. If, however, it be desired to make a brave man of him, he can without doubt become one, providing he receive the proper training, which would require, of course, great exertion. So I think the Rambam is doing two things here. The Rambam says we aren't born with virtue or vice. We're not born good people, or we are not born as evil people. In doing so, the Rambam is making two points. One, he's saying that we have the choice to use tools at our disposal. But two, he's also saying being born with gifts does not make you virtuous. And being born with deficiencies does not make you guilty of vice. I think this is a pretty important point that we really ought to drive home, especially to younger children and the like. Because you know what children always say, you know, oh, she's so smart, or, you know, she's so X, or she's so whatever she is. You know, she's so popular. And I think often in our society, we conflate talent and gifts with achievement and virtue. What the Rambam is saying is just because a person is born with a certain talent does not mean that they are virtuous. That is not virtue. That is not your choice. You do not choose the genetics that you have. Just as you don't choose your height, you don't choose, you know, your hair color, you don't choose your intellectual gifts. What the Rambam is saying is that it is upon each person to use whatever gifts they have for the better, as the Rambam described earlier. And he's arguing, and maybe you would take issue with this, he's arguing even someone who lacks those gifts with the appropriate training could, with the appropriate training, achieve all of the virtues that the person who has those gifts could achieve. It seems that's what he's arguing. So we'll pause here for a second. Paul, you wanted to ask something? Go for it. You're muted, my friend. I'm trying to unmute you. There you go.
I think the modern day geneticists would disagree. There is some genetic code which clearly provides a predisposition to certain mental and physical traits that he's ignoring.
Why do you think he's ignoring that though? That's exactly what he said.
That's what he says.
he's saying
circumstances make the difference.
See, here's what I like your argument.
No,
here's,
but
here's
you,
my,
you,
my issue would be. I think you could argue that, look, Rambam might say this, but certain things, look, let me give you a pretty easy example, right? You have professional athletes, right? Do you really mean to tell me, you know, people who play professional sports like basketball or baseball or soccer, and they're pretty good, and they have certain natural talents? It's, I think, a bit of a stretch to say any one of us could have also accomplished the same things if we had put our minds to it and trained ourselves. I'm not sure. You could argue, I think maybe as we were saying, Paul, that maybe there is a limit to our talents. Maybe someone lacking certain intelligence naturally cannot reach the same heights that Albert Einstein could, right? Maybe, you know, those who have photographic memories, right? Who can memorize just volumes and volumes. If a person, you know, wanted to achieve the same amount of knowledge and they didn't have the same mental capacity, they couldn't. You could argue that. Maybe there are certain limitations upon our ultimate achievement of virtue based on our natural deficiencies. Maybe certain people just don't have it within them to acquire so much knowledge. So that I would hear. But I think he's saying people do have predispositions genetically. He's making an argument. But I think ultimately then maybe we have to rethink what's virtue and what's vice. But I hear what you're saying. Good? Okay. So now the Rambam is going to say why I think this is so important. This was a big issue at the time. It says as follows. I have entered into this subject so you may not believe the absurd ideas of astrologers who falsely assert that the constellation at the time of one's birth determines whether one is virtuous or vicious, the individual being thus necessarily compelled to follow out a certain line of conduct, right? So the Rambam is telling you what he doesn't believe. He doesn't believe in astrology. He doesn't think that, you know, if you were born in a certain month and a certain date and you have a certain star, whatever it is, you can look it up in the New York Times. I think there used to at least be a section where you could sort of look these things up. So that means if you're born in July, you're going to be an angry person. And if you're born in, I don't know, March, you're going to be a generous person. And the Rambam says that all is nonsensical. What he's dispelling is that there is nothing inherently which requires you to act in a certain way. We do not believe that. We, on the contrary, are convinced, and this is, again, a line that I think we've seen consistent with the Rambam general idea, that our law, our Torah, agrees with Greek philosophy. And Rambam wants both of those on his team, which substantiates with convincing proofs the contention that man's conduct is entirely in his own hands. Now, that is quite a statement. Man's conduct is entirely in his own hands. That is a bit different than I think what we were saying in our introduction. It's not simply the Rambam saying most of our decisions are in our own hands, or a lot of decisions in our own hands, or some decisions are in our own hands. The Rambam saying our conduct's entirely in our own hands. That is a pretty radical statement. I don't think all
theoretically
agree with this. Sorry?
Theoretically only.
Well, we'll have to see what he says. Let's see. That no compulsion is exerted and that no external influence is brought to bear upon him that constrains him. Again, not that there are no external influences. There are external influences, but they don't constrain a person. They don't require a person to be either virtuous or vicious, except in as much as, according to what we have said above, he may be by nature so constituted as to find it easier, hard, as the case may be, to do a certain thing. So it could be something will be very hard for you to do because of external influence. There are a lot of things can make things hard or easy. That the Rambam doesn't deny. So free will doesn't mean there is nothing pushing me in either direction. There are many things pushing me in many directions all the time. However, but that he must necessarily do, that it is inconceivable otherwise, that a person must do or refrain from doing a certain thing is absolutely untrue. There is nothing forcing you or compelling you to make any given decision. So what the Rambam, I think the best way probably to understand the Rambam's position is based on what he says is not true. The Rambam's free will means nothing is compelling you to act in a certain way. The ultimate decision is up to you. Whatever factors exist pushing you in any given direction, you have agency to overcome them and choose the other alternative. So I think that this, the Rambam, I think essentially is arguing for here is returning agency to the human. Don't give me an excuse, the Rambam says. Don't tell me, listen, it wasn't my fault because I naturally wanted X, or they told me, or I was raised in this way, or there's so much social pressure to do whatever it is that you say you had to do. All those certainly exist. There's social pressure. There is a certain disposition that we had based on the way we were born and the way we were raised. All that's true. Ultimately, whose decision is it? Yours. That's the Rambam's definition of at least what he's arguing here for free choice. It's simply that we are not compelled toward either alternative of doing or not doing. And now he gives a theological argument for this. What would you say, based on, before we look at it, religiously, based on our Torah, based on what we know to be our belief about the world and the way the world works and the way God looks at us and judges our decisions, what would you say is the most basic argument that it has to be? On a theological level, we have the freedom to choose to do or not do all of our actions. Why does it have to be that we have this? As Jewish people, what do we have to do?
We have to observe the mitzvah.
Right. Now, does that make any sense for God to require us to observe mitzvot if we are compelled to either do them or not to do them? The obvious answer is no. How could you have a mitzvah, a commandment, in any sense? And this Rambam saying something Rambam said before, when the Rambam was talking about the different realms of human behavior, and you know, versus the emotions and versus, you know, our feelings and our thoughts and our actions, etc., you know, and our beliefs. And the Rambam enumerated the different realms of human activity. And the Rambam said that mitzvot only exist within certain realms of human activity. So God can't give you a mitzvah to sneeze or not to sneeze, right? And even in terms of beliefs, the Rambam went back and forth. Some say that humans cannot control our beliefs. He says, no, I think we can. The reason the Rambam told us which realms of human behavior essentially do contain the mitzvah is because he thinks if you can't control it, there cannot be a mitzvah. God cannot command you to do something if the decision is not yours, if you are compelled to do it or not to do it. So for there to be any mitzvah, and furthermore, any consequence for doing mitzvot or not doing them, for doing a vir or not doing them, it is obvious. It follows that we have to have, ultimately, the decision to do them or not. Were a man compelled to act, continues the Rambam, according to the dictates of predestination, right? Based on the way that we were born, muchrach al pulotav, then the commandments and prohibitions of the law would become null and void. There would be no room for the Torah at all. And the law would be completely false, since man would have no freedom of choice in what he does. Moreover, it would be useless, in fact, absolutely in vain, for man to study, to instruct, or attempt to learn an art, as it would be entirely impossible for him on account of the external force compelling him. This is a very, by the way, let me just, as an aside, there are some in today's day and age who sort of argue for determinism and argue that really we don't have free choice and that ultimately we don't have control of our actions and we're just sort of playing out a determined course for our lives based on biology, etc. And I think this is the biggest issue they have to grapple with, which is we all have an internal sort of assumption that we ought to judge on a moral way. That we ought to judge and only judge people based on the morality of their actions. That we put people in prison only because what they did was wrong and they had control over it. That we can incarcerate people or punish them, even in certain places, give the death penalty because of the fact that they were responsible for what they did. And if you believe in determinism, how could you have any responsibility for any of your actions? How can we punish anybody? How can we put anyone in prison? How can we give, it's hard to justify any of it. So that is an answer, that is a big problem that determinists need to address. And the Rambam is saying, I don't think there's really a good answer to this. Some people will say things like, you know, maybe we don't have free will, but for the betterment of society, whether it was their choice or not, we need to react in a way which is going to produce certain outcomes. Some people say there's still room for effort somehow. But it's a very hard question. If you don't believe in free will, how do you have any room for effort in anything? Right? So he's saying it's not just mitzvot. How can you study to instruct or attempt to learn an art, as it would be entirely impossible for him on account of the external force compelling him, according to the opinion of those who hold this view, to keep from doing a certain act, from gaining a certain knowledge, or from acquiring a certain characteristic. You all chose to be here tonight, didn't you? Probably because you wanted to learn something or learn from the Rambam. Maybe because you like the sound of my voice for whatever weird reason. But you all chose to be here tonight. How do you even reckon with that? What compelled you to do that? The fact that you're here indicates that you think that you might learn something or gain from it. That means you weren't predetermined to learn it or not. Right? Reward and punishment, too, would be pure injustice, both as regards man towards man as between man, God, and man. Suppose under such conditions that Shimon should kill Reuven. Why should the four be punished, seeing that he was constrained to do the killing? And Reuven was predestined to be slain. How could the Almighty, who is just and righteous, right? We say Hashem is Sadik v'Yashar. Avram Avinu goes to God and says, how could you punish the people of Sodom? You, all the righteous in Sodom, if there are righteous people in the city, you are a just God. Hashofei kol aretz. But how can God be just if he's punishing people for actions they have no control over? How could the Almighty, who is just and righteous, chastise Shimon for a deed which was impossible for him to leave undone, and which, though he strove with all his might, he would have been unable to avoid? If such were this true state of affairs, all precautionary measures, just building houses, providing means of subsistence, fleeing when one fears danger, and so forth, would be absolutely useless, for that which is decreed beforehand must necessarily happen. This theory is therefore positively unsound, contrary to reason and common sense, subversive of the fundamental principles of religion, and attributes and justice to God. Attributes and justice to God, right? So Rambam is saying, it is just absolutely inconceivable to accept determinism, that we are just determined to act in certain ways, and certain things are just going to happen to us necessarily, no matter what, regardless of what we decide or what we might do about that. It just goes against everything that we believe in on a religious level, on a basic intellectual level. The very notion of effort runs against this notion. What's the point of putting an effort into anything if it's all predetermined anyway? That's the Rambam's argument here. I do think it's a powerful one that we all intuitively feel. The fact that we put effort into things assumes that we feel that we control our action. And I will just note, and I saw this in an article in The Atlantic in 2016. Actually, the author of this article argued that he thinks that their determinism is true and that we are in control of our actions. But we ought to hide this truth from people, and we shouldn't spill the secret. And should we should tell people that they really do have free choice, even though they don't. You know why I said that? Because studies have shown that when people think they're not truly in control of their actions, you know what the results are? Bad. The results are bad. They cheat more. There was an experiment where, you know, people were giving different articles arguing for the lack of free will. And then they were all told that in return for doing that, they would get paid $1. And they were given a bag with more than $1 in it. And all the people that were given articles which argued for free will just took $1. And the people that were given articles that said you don't have free choice took more than $1. Then there were studies which show that employers are more approve on a higher level those who believe in free will than those who don't. So it's a consequential argument here. It goes to show that people who truly think they don't have real agency, often that belief ultimately does result in a lack of effort, in a lack of dedication, in a lack of honesty, in a lack of virtue. Because they say, look, you can't hold me accountable because I had no choice. It's not ultimately my decision. Yes, Paul.
Can't a strict upbringing, a very strict upbringing, remove that issue of free will? Can't people be brainwashed to such a degree through their upbringing that they feel that they have no choice and they must follow what they were brought up to believe is true?
I think that would just be another one of those external influences, which certainly influences their decision-making, but it doesn't compel them. It's not, there's a difference between, like, let me say a very basic example. I think that's helpful. This bottle, if you see it, is green, right? We see it's green. Did it necessarily have to be green? Is it inconceivable otherwise? Could you imagine this bottle being blue? You could, right?
Because we've formed it.
Right. That's true. But the point is, you're right, Paul, that if given a certain upbringing, a very strict upbringing, brainwashing, etc., people will often choose a certain path. But was it necessarily so that they had to? Is it inconceivable otherwise they choose that path? I don't think so.
There are people who are brought up in very, very strict religious homes, whether they're Catholic homes or Buddhist homes or Shinto homes or Orthodox Judaism, who don't tolerate any deviation from what they were brought up and are brainwashed to the extent that this is the only thing that they believe. They have no free will.
But I think I agree with that. I think that just means
they they're conditioned that way. That doesn't mean they don't have the capacity for
ultimately,
change.
Okay, I don't want to get into a time match here, but I think, look, Paul, I think you're right. It's certainly a very strong influence, but there have been people from such strict homes who have left the fold. Maybe they've run away. Maybe they've escaped. And then they've totally rejected all of it. Such things have happened. The very mere possibility that such a thing could happen means that that it doesn't go against the Rambam saying. The Rambam's agreeing there could be a lot of external factors that drive a person toward a certain choice very heavily. You could even run statistics, and 99% of people in that situation would make a certain choice. You can look at our own community, and there are probably very high percentages of people who make certain decisions in our community. But is it inevitable? Is it inconceivable otherwise? Are they compelled to do so? I think we argued at the beginning what the Rambam was saying is no, they were not compelled to do so. They were very, very heavily influenced to do so, but they ultimately had the last choice. Ultimately, it was their decision. No one took their hand and, you know, pushed it in any direction, right? That would be not in a person's choice. I think we would agree. But as long as that didn't happen, so it's still within the realm of their choice, right? Okay. So, and the Rambam was going to, maybe we'll end this paragraph. The Rambam was going to prove this from Sukkim the Torah itself. And the Torah emphasizes this again and again. In reality, the undoubted truth of the matter is that a man has full sway over all his actions. If he wishes to do a thing, he does it. If he does not wish to do it, he need not, without any external compulsion controlling him. There's no no one's pulling the strings. We're not just puppets. Therefore, God very properly commanded, saying, very famous portion in the end of the Torah, I believe at the end of Mitzvim, or Vayelech, actually. He says, right? See, I have set before you this day life and the good, death and evil. I've set it before you. Therefore, choose life. Uvacharta b'chayim, God says, choose life. That certainly seems to indicate we have a choice, giving us, as regards these, freedom of choice. Consequently, punishment is inflicted upon those who disobey and reward granted to the obedient. The whole Torah is one message, right? If you wanted to summarize the Bible in one sentence, what would that sentence be? If you listen to God, it shall be good. If you do not listen, it shall be bad, right? Again and again. If you will hearken and Vayikra, if you will not listen, learning and teaching are also necessary. Right, so the Rambam had argued that it doesn't make any sense to argue for any sort of study or training if ultimately decisions are not ours. Well, the Torah does argue for both learning and training. And if it does argue for both learning and training, clearly the Torah believes, like the Rambam ascribes to the Greek philosophers, that we do have the ultimate freedom to choose what decision you want to make. Learning, so it says, you shall teach them to your children, and you shall do them and observe to do them, right? And similarly, all the other passage referring to the study of the commandments. It is also necessary to take all the precautionary measures laid down in the law. There are precautionary measures, such as, you shall make a battlement for your roof, that you bring not blood upon your house, right? We have a mitzvah called ma'akeh. Ma'akeh means you build a fence around the roof of your house. Clearly, that means that it's worth putting in effort to prevent people from falling off of your house. But if people had no choice as to whether or not they wanted to jump off the roof of your house, there would be no point upon making a fence around your house because it would be predetermined. They've already made that decision. So what is your fence going to do? It obviously assumes that people have a choice not to fall off of your house, but they will often, hopefully, please God, if they're mentally healthy, choose not to fall off of your house. And therefore, you should put a fence. So in the event in which they slip and fall, then they'll be guarded, right? Lest he die in the battle, right? We say to somebody that is going to war, the head of the war says to them, the Kohen says, if you're afraid that you're going to die, you go home. Well, clearly then he has a choice to go home. Wherein shall he sleep? And no man shall take to pledge the nether or the upper mills. There's a millstone, right? That's the law of if taking it. You shouldn't take someone's millstone as collateral because they need that millstone in order to make a living, which means that number one, I can choose not to take the millstone, and also that the person using the millstone can choose to make a living. And then the other passages in regard to precautions found in the law and the prophets. So the Rambam is arguing that ultimately there is nothing compelling us to make any specific decision. And next week, the Rambam deals with two different things. Okay? Two different things the Rambam deals with. One is the source in Chazal. Chazal sometimes say, everything's in the hands of heaven. Everything's in the hands of heaven except for fear of heaven. Or we ask for in a Chazal, right. Certain things seem to be predetermined. Right. Certain things seem to be predetermined. Who a person's going to marry, predetermined. So how do you deal with that if ultimately the decision is ours? That's one question. And then we have the other textual questions from the Bible of like Paro, whose heart was hardened. How do you understand that, etc. So next week, the Rambam deals with that. So I do want to leave you with the following, though. Because I think, here's why I think this is really important. I do feel that this belief in human agency to determine our actions has taken a hit in today's day and age. And I think that certain, you know, movements and philosophies have argued that, you know what, such and such was born in such and such a way. It's not their fault. That's the way they are. This is the way they were born. They had no choice but to act in such and such a way. So how can we fault them for doing so? And I think even certain things in terms of education, of taking away advanced tracks or taking away, you know, certain courses for the more gifted students, point to this, where they say, look, certain people don't have the capability to achieve and strive to be at the top of the class. And so we must take away those opportunities from others because it's not fair. And beyond the political decision-making there, I think there's another point. I think it's against our best interests to ever say that because someone was born a certain way that they can't achieve, that it's impossible, it's inconceivable. There's no way they can do it. And I think because we often say such things, it leads to bad consequences. They believe it too. And it'd be much more beneficial to say it is very difficult in a lot of situations to achieve certain things, but it is possible. It is within the realm of human agency. It is not inconceivable. You can, given the right circumstances and training and effort, achieve. And I think that part of what our mission should be based on this Rambam is to return agency to the humans, to put our decisions more in our hands. So, because once you say, it's not really up to me, I can't, that excuses a lack of effort. That excuses a lack of striving to achieve our potential. The Rambam is giving us the ability to strive to reach our potential because he's saying the ultimate question of what you do and who you become is up to you. And that, I think, is a very important message. So we'll stop here for this week. I think next week, we'll continue with this. Maybe I'll present a few more perspectives. Maybe then I hopefully will finish with eight chapters and we can do a little something for Purim, and we'll take it from there. Thanks, everybody. I really appreciate your learning and your participation. And